This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, December 28th, 2012. I'm Caleb Brown. With just days before they expire, the Senate has reauthorized sweeping federal powers to eavesdrop on Americans' communications without a warrant. Amendments to the statute offered to shore up Americans' freedom from unwarranted searches of their records were tossed aside. Julian Sanchez, a research fellow at the Cato Institute, comments on today's vote.
The Senate has approved by a lopsided 73-23 vote the reauthorization of the FISA Amendments Act. And what we saw was a really sort of extraordinary spectacle on the Senate floor that really just extended a pattern we've seen for several years now with counterterror surveillance legislation passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, which is to say, for months and months and months, there's a reauthorization deadline coming up. Everyone knows it. Nothing really is done. There aren't meaningful hearings. There's no real debate. And then a few days before, in this case 4 days before, the law is slated to expire, they essentially gave in to Ron Wyden, who'd been gumming things up, and allowed debate on a series of amendments. But then, of course, the totally manufactured urgency that they've created, because there's no time to get the House to vote on any amendments or approve a changed package, means that forget it, sorry, we can have a kind of fake debate, but we can't afford to risk letting this lapse for a couple of days, even though, of course, under the law, authorizations for surveillance program, for programmatic surveillance of international communications, authorizations last for a year. So it's not like anything would happen. It's not like there would be a gap in their ability to collect suddenly if the legislation had expired for a week or two. Yet that was the rationale for saying it was not really possible to seriously consider the amendments that were offered. And you sort of suspect that they did this because one just didn't hear any compelling arguments for why these very common sense amendments couldn't be added as additional, very mild checks for the most part. Senator Jeff Merkley offered an amendment for what I thought was a pretty common sense basic principle of liberal democracy, which is that there shouldn't be secret law, that the way the secret FISA court interprets the statute really is what determines what its scope is, what it means, what kind of surveillance is really permitted. We know in a bunch of cases that those courts or government lawyers have interpreted some of these surveillance powers in ways that many senators have said would shock someone who was just reading the text of the bill. So to meaningfully debate whether these surveillance powers are working or appropriate, we need to know how the court has interpreted them how far their scope really extends.
And some senators have pointed out well before this that they believe that there is a broad gulf between how these statutes are being interpreted with their own understanding of
– So Ron Wyden has said about a number of statutes that there is in effect in respect to the Patriot Act, he said there's basically a secret Patriot Act because the interpretations differ so radically from what an ordinary person would understand from reading the statute. So Jeff Merkley, I thought, quite reasonably said, unless it would be deleterious to national security, the Justice Department should release redacted, declassified versions of major interpretations. And yet this was shot down. It was hard to see why exactly. I think Saxby Chambliss suggested that somehow even after the Justice Department has reviewed these and cleansed them of anything that could compromise sources and methods, that still somehow brilliant terrorists would glean some valuable information that would allow them to evade surveillance. It wasn't really explained why we should think that's likely.
But broadly, it seems like their argument is we can't let you know how the FISA court is interpreting these statutes because then the terrorists would know? Is that basically right?
Yeah. I mean, the idea here is right. Even if they don't know the technical details of how the NSA conducts surveillance, if they know anything about what kind of questions the FISA court is being asked to answer, that this would be information they could somehow use to evade surveillance. I mean, it's somewhat wacky, frankly. It's really impossible for me to imagine how information at that level could actually permit someone to evade surveillance. But that was the argument that was made. Really, it was the fact that there were only 4 days to go that that carried the day on all of these things. Ron Wyden had a couple of amendments that I thought were, again, should be stunning that this is not something that's done already automatically. Two proposals. One, just that the NSA should have to estimate how many Americans are being swept up in its surveillance dragnet. Again, this is supposedly a surveillance program targeting foreigners. Because of the way the law is written, that restriction is actually extraordinarily weak. There's almost certainly many thousands, if not millions, of American communications swept up in the process, including very likely some entirely domestic ones. It was just claimed that that it's impossible to produce that estimate. Dianne Feinstein actually at one point said, well, there's a secret memorandum explaining the reason they can't do this. And so if you want to know why this amendment is impossible, come to the secret room where you can read the secret memo alone in this secure facility and learn the reason why you should vote against this amendment. Another prohibiting what Wyden has called backdoor searches. The NSA objects to this characterization, but the idea here is that collection is initially so broad, even if it nominally has a foreign target, that because so many American communications are going to be swept up, if it's not supposed to be used to target Americans, then once all those communications are sitting in the NSA's database, it shouldn't be possible to circumvent the spirit of the law by then plugging in an American's name or other identifying information to effectively, after the fact, use this vast database as a way of kind of ex post picking on Americans to spy on. That, again, was shot down. It seems like if, as the supporters of this law want to insist, it's really only about targeting foreigners, then consistent with that idea, they should welcome this kind of restriction that a warrant be obtained before a specific American's name is punched into the search. Yet again, of course, that was shot down. Pat Leahy wanted a shorter sunset, so perhaps we could have a more meaningful debate from 5 years to 3 years. He wanted to sort of shrink the span of reauthorization, again shot down as well. Rand Paul had a largely symbolic and fairly dramatic amendment that would have asserted that the Fourth Amendment protects third-party records. I mean, this is in a lot of ways very sensible, but would have been a huge sea change in American surveillance law. So it's not terribly surprising that that didn't pass.
But aren't we moving in that direction generally? I mean, we had in the U.S. v. Jones case, was it Sonia Sotomayor arguing that this third-party doctrine is something that needs to be, if not gotten rid of, at least looked at very seriously?
Yeah, we've seen Sonia Sotomayor and a number of other judges at federal appellate courts beginning to push back against the so-called third-party doctrine, this doctrine that when you're internet service provider, your phone company has communications or other records about your internet activity or phone activity, that you've waived your expectation of privacy in that data. In the 21st century, given the way we live now, that this 30-plus-year-old doctrine really vitiates the Fourth Amendment if you take it to its extreme. And so there's been a move to say it's time to reconsider that or at least cabin it in. So that is the way the courts seem to eventually be leaning. But, we didn't really have even an appellate level decision about whether the Fourth Amendment protects email, a finding that it does in fact apply to at least some email until 2010. So these things move through the courts incredibly slowly. There's no reason to think that even if that's the way the courts want to go, it's somewhere that they're going to get soon. The thing we heard again and again in this debate was one, that we've created this sort of phony urgency and so there's no time to seriously consider any of these amendments and make changes, but also that we have this incredibly robust oversight that will prevent any problems. And we know, of course, that we've already found a series of issues where overcollection of totally domestic communications occurred. The FISA court has ruled in one case that surveillance authorized by the law had in fact violated the Fourth Amendment, was unreasonable in the language of the Fourth Amendment. And somewhat perversely, we had folks like Senator Saxby Chambliss arguing that this just shows how well oversight works and that no further checks are necessary. There's sort of a catch-22 here. If you don't find any misuse of the authority, well, that just goes to show it's being used well and we don't need additional safeguards. And if they do find a misuse, then you assume that you've found it all and therefore We don't need any additional safeguards. They also point out, well, most of the problems they found appear to be the result of error as opposed to malicious abuse of the authority. And this is something I've always thought of as the Stephen Glass problem. The fraudulent journalist Stephen Glass published a wide array of totally fabricated stories in the New Republic, which had a very notoriously rigorous fact-check process. And what they realized after the fact was the fact-check process was great at catching errors, but not that good at catching deliberate fraud by people who understood how the fact-check worked and could tailor their fabrications to avoid getting caught by the fact-check, by, for example, fabricating backup sources for the fact-checkers to look at. I think something very similar obtains with respect to intelligence oversight. People who are not trying to conceal their misuse of the authority or their violation of the rules are easy to spot because they're not doing anything to hide their activity. That's no guarantee that people who understand how the oversight works might not be able to evade detection by those systems, especially given that the oversight really does seem to be focused at the collection stage, is to say whether interception is consistent with what's been authorized. And the trouble there is that the interception is so broad that a lot of collection of innocent communications is not a violation of the rules. What you really need to worry about is how that data is being searched and used after the fact. That's why I think Ron Wyden's amendment requiring a warrant for searches of the database to pick up American communications was so important. And it's, again, very difficult if you have a, you know, moderately savvy bad actor to spot that kind of misuse. It certainly would be nothing new historically if people within the intelligence agencies decided that information obtained for legitimate intelligence reasons, or at least picked up in the course of a legitimate intelligence investigation, might also be mined for some illegitimate political purpose. Notoriously, Richard Nixon practiced this, but presidents for decades, did this, and it's something that we should worry, could happen again. But no one really seems to be concerned about that. People did raise these concerns on the Senate floor, but there just doesn't seem to be a willingness to really go back and reconsider these sweeping authorities that we've introduced in the last 10 years.
Julian Sanchez is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.